Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup, Racha.
Thank you, Racha. Thank you, Kuyo. And thank you to the House of World Culture for having organised these 3 days of meetings between scholars, researchers, filmmakers, curators, and everybody who's interested in this chapter of film history.
Thanks.
Before I start to address the actual topic, I'd first of all like to explain how, as a historian studying Russia, I came to work on the training of filmmakers from the Arab world, the African world, at the VGIK. And of course, this brief biographical introduction will allow me to embed this history in a broader context and to look at the ways in which film training was carried out in the Soviet Union, and also to look at this as part of national history and the struggle for national liberation through films and filmmaking. Now, before looking at the current situation and this topic, I looked at the way in which the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s addressed these issues in films. Efforts were made in the 20s and 30s to present the various different nationalities in the Soviet Union. And in the 20s and 30s, there were around 160 such nationalities in the Soviet Union. And these were peoples with cultures and religions and languages, which were very different. The Soviet authorities took the view after the 1917 revolution that in order to remedy the injustices experienced in the Tsarist era, every people had the right to express themselves in their own language and to represent the specific details of their culture and lifestyle, and to do this in various different media and cultural formats. The press in the 20s, for example, there were various different articles in Yiddish, in Arabic, and also in minor languages from the Caucasus and Central Asia. Also in the theatre, there were various different theatrical groups set up in the 20s with actors from various different countries, of various different nationalities. The radio played a role too. The cinema was pushed to the forefront by the Soviet government. It was an absolutely new art form. In 1917, cinema was just 20 or so years old. And on this basis, the development of cinema accompanied the birth of a new society and a new political model in the Soviet Union. Cinema also made it possible to disseminate the same message from Moscow to populations right across this enormous country, the former Russian Empire, which became the Soviet Union from 1922 onwards. Populists were, on the whole, illiterate after the Russian Revolution, at least immediately afterwards. The political authorities therefore felt they would respond all the more to images, and that this would be a way that people could be influenced in their views as well, through images. Filmmaking and cinema was not readily accessible to all other nationalities. First of all, electricity was not available everywhere across the Soviet Union. There were itinerant cinemas that were set up, which moved from city to city. Filmmaking equipment was also in short supply. When the Russian Revolution occurred, you may remember that a number of filmmakers left to other countries with their equipment, to France and to Germany, for example. And in Russia, prior to the Second World War, film stock was not produced in Russia, so there was a real lack of technical resources to make films. The Soviet government focused in particular on the cinema, first of all as a communication tool aimed at very different nationalities, but also as a showcase, because through film, the Soviet Union wanted to demonstrate its policy, its egalitarian policy, and its policy of promoting every single individual and supporting them irrespective of their origins or indeed ethnic background. The Soviet government promoted the production of films representing the various Soviet nationalities, those nationalities found within the Soviet Union, and to convey an authentic image of these people. These images were, of course, intended to be different from images created by colonial powers presenting colonized peoples. It was felt that the various different nationalities should be trained in filmmaking so that they, with camera in hand, could represent their own history and culture. That would mean that people from different cultures would be able to produce films and to give an authentic interpretation of their own culture. In order to speed up the pace of this development, the Soviet government created quotas in the universities. I'm talking about this with reference to filmmaking, but it also applied in other fields as well and for other disciplines. And in the VGIK, the Moscow Cinema Institute, at the end of the 20s, quotas were established for different nationalities in order to train cinematographers, directors, and others in filmmaking skills. In addition, teams were sent to Central Asia and to the Caucasus in order to do training on the spot, to train projectionists. It wasn't just a matter of sending material to be screened, but also it was important to train people who were equipped to create the right situation for projecting films and to project films. And at the same time, for example, screenwriting classes were organized for the Chechens and the Tajiks in the 1920s on the spot. I say all this by way of introduction to explain the film training program and also the focus on support for people from Africa and Asia to train filmmakers. This was not something brand new, but it was part of a rhetoric that's already been rehearsed many years before. Many African and Arab intellectuals are familiar with Soviet history and claim this Soviet lineage of education through cinema. As in the Soviet Union in the 1920s, in Africa, at the point in time when countries became independent, cinema was viewed as a wonderful tool to educate populations which were largely illiterate. It was felt that cinema, as a modern development, should flank revitalization of African societies, and indeed that it was essential that Africans could pick up the camera to represent their country authentically. One of the first to be trained in the Soviet Union was Semben Usman, a writer who subsequently became a filmmaker. He was trained for several months at the Gorky Studios in 1961 with Mark Donskoy, as you'll see on the slide. Semben Usman said the following, and I quote, this was in the 1960s, by the way, when Lenin, in the first years following the October Revolution, said, of all the arts, for us the cinema is most important. The battle against illiteracy was scarcely beginning. Now, for us in Africa, Lenin's words are entirely topical. We can make films that depict significant sociopolitical issues, the struggle against neocolonialism, moving from an obsolete Africa to a new Africa. And wherever on our continent the film is screened, these problems will be understood. So you can see there's a discourse between what happened in the 1920s and what happened in the 1950s and early 1960s in several countries in Africa, particularly involving intellectuals familiar with the history of what had happened in the Soviet Union earlier. We should bear in mind that cinema has existed in Africa since the late 19th century. We've talked a lot about cinema in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even 80s, but that's what we've talked about over the last few days. But cinema actually emerged in Africa very soon after the first films were screened in Paris. And going to the cinema was part and parcel of leisure activities undertaken by citizens of African countries, even since the interwar period. And that became even more pronounced after the Second World War. A French historian, Odile Gueug, has demonstrated this very clearly in her book, Fantômes sous les Tropiques, Fantômes in the Tropics, looking at various different archives and eyewitness reports to talk about the way in which films were received in Western Equatorial Africa. There are various different cinematographic practices. Think, for example, of Egypt, but also the former British colonies and French and Portuguese colonies are indeed Italian. Here you can see a cinema built by the Italians in Eritrea in 1937 to demonstrate that there are historical film theatres in various countries in Africa. And this architecture also recounts a chapter in film history and in cinematic history. One shared point, particularly with reference to cinemas in French-speaking Africa, is that there was a lack of infrastructure for cinematographic production. A very limited number of African filmmakers working on a professional basis. The situation was different in Egypt or in the British colonies, where many production structures were set up. Inter alia, in Sudan, has to be said that the colonial powers, although they did develop distribution channels to show films both to colonists and certain segments of the colonized population, they did actually have private sector distribution of films. Nevertheless, the colonial powers did not authorize Africans to use filmmaking equipment. They were also reluctant to allow others to make films in Africa out of concern that there would be criticism of the colonial system. Those who did try, such as, for example, René Vautier in his film Afrique 50, Africa 50, had their film reels confiscated, at least in part, and their films were censored subsequently. In the early 1950s, there was, however, a turning point. First of all, there was the establishment of the first film school, IDHEC, the Supreme Institute of Film Studies in Paris. It was set up in 1944. Several students from French colonies studied there, particularly students from Morocco and Tunisia. After the independence of many other African countries, more students arrived to study at the film school in Paris. You can see a list here, which is incomplete, but just to give you a general overview of the places that these students came from and the dates when they arrived in France to study at the IDHEC. Ahmed Belashmi was the first to arrive at ITEC in 1949, and then you can see other filmmakers from Morocco, from what at the time was called Dahomey, Pauline Béret, one of the most striking figures of this renaissance of African cinema, which really was part of a call for African cinema to be created by Africans. Subsequently, you'll see filmmakers from Tunisia, from the Côte d'Ivoire, from Senegal, from the Upper Volta, all of whom trained as filmmakers in Paris in the late 1940s and the early 1950s. Looking to the British colonies as well, there are also a number of important filmmakers. Think, for example, of Gadla Gubara, trained in Cairo and subsequently in London. The British set up a film unit in Sudan before decolonization, and a number of Sudanese had actually been trained as filmmakers at that point in time. As Constantine Katsiakouris told us yesterday, the Soviet Union took up a position as a privileged interlocutor at the time of independence emerging across Africa and wished to be involved on this basis with countries that had become newly independent. People often talk about military assistance provided by the Soviet Union to these countries within the context of the Cold War, but often the cultural and artistic aspects are left to one side. At a recent exhibition in the House of World Culture, you may have seen references to this as well, to the fact that cultural cooperation was crucially important too. From the late 1950s on, the Soviet Union provided support in areas such as the development of sport, for example. Football teams across Africa were sponsored by the Soviet Union. The same applies to dance, music, the fine arts, and also to cinema. Here, too, significant assistance came from the Soviet Union. Here you can see a poster entitled Good Morning, Africa. Posters and other fine arts products celebrated and commemorated support and assistance from the Soviet Union to these newly independent states. Why was there such a focus on the cinema, both on the part of the Soviets and on the part of countries in Africa and the Middle East? From the Soviet point of view, this assistance can be explained in political terms and in economic terms. In political terms, for the Soviet Union, it was all about disseminating communist ideology to an enormous number of countries, seeking to convince them of the superiority of the communist model, which was, of course, much better in their eyes than the capitalist model. People often say that this film history is about propaganda, but it's not the whole story. And the economic aspect has also been very important as well for the Soviet Union, particularly after the revolution. Let's bear in mind that Soviet films weren't widely disseminated, for example, in French colonies. That's because the colonial powers did not want to see the spread of communist ideology. However, some Soviet films were disseminated through film clubs. These were very well organized film clubs and were rather influential even before independence and decolonization. Independence meant that it was possible to break down this wall, so to speak, relating to access to Soviet films. It opened up a new market for the dissemination of Soviet films. And that also, of course, meant a new source of revenue for the Soviet Union. From the African perspective, this assistance was welcome. It was very important for the African authorities to break away from an exclusive and binary relationship with European powers, with former colonizing powers, for example, France or Great Britain. they sought to diversify the partners they engaged with. This was the case even when governments were not socialist. Furthermore, Soviet cinema was very well known, had an outstanding reputation. Training at the VGIK was particularly prestigious. There were not an enormous number of film schools during this period initially. And furthermore, the Soviet Union offered scope to screen films as broadly as possible in their own country to educate people, but they also offered scope to train African filmmakers. This is how it came about that various cooperation agreements were signed between the Soviet Union and several countries in Africa, and this related to economic and military realms, but also to the cultural sphere. Here you can see two photos of Sékou Touré, who in autumn 1959 went to Crimea to meet Nikita Khrushchev and to sign these first agreements. Subsequent agreements were also signed with 16 different countries in Africa in 1961, or at least by 1961. This was done in Tunisia, Morocco, Guinea, Ghana, Ethiopia, and Somalia, to cite just a few examples. Even before Senben Usman started to train as a filmmaker in Moscow, there were two Guineans who were the first filmmakers, at least as far as my sources indicate, to have trained in filmmaking in Moscow. Sékou Touré sent two young men in 1959. Bob Sow, Sow Mamadou was his real name. I don't know his date of birth, but I know that he was assassinated in 1970. And Touré Khalil, who did a training course at the Central Studio for Documentary Film in Moscow, and Alexander Medvedkin and Kirill Nikitin trained them, very important figures in Soviet cinema. They made a first documentary film entitled Cet Hiver à Moscou, That Winter in Moscow. This was a film looking at the first African students in Moscow. Unfortunately, I have not yet managed to find this film in the Russian archives, but I haven't given up. I still hope to find it. Within the context of this assistance program, the Soviet Union also sent film projectors so that films could be screened, Soviet films and films from elsewhere, French films and Guinean films, as soon as these Guinean films were produced. What you see on this slide is André Taralin, a Soviet diplomat, accompanying these 10 projectors. He remained in Conakry for several months in order to train Guineans to work as film projectionists. And here you can see his students who are learning to be projectionists sitting together with André Taralin. From that point in time on, as part of political, economic, cultural, and educational exchanges that became increasingly significant and were a central part of relations between the Soviet Union and countries in Africa and the Middle East, an increasing number of young Africans were trained in filmmaking courses. That also applied for students from the Middle East, particularly from Iraq, in the 1960s. Subsequently, also from Syria and Palestine in the 1960s, young students from Guinea were trained, from Ethiopia, and also from Morocco. What you see on this slide at the photos that I've managed to find of the student cards of the young people in question. So you can see Michel Papatakis, who graduated in 1965. He's viewed as the first Ethiopian filmmaker. Nikos Papatakis is, of course, somebody else. That's his brother. You shouldn't be confused. Terikin Gatachu, also an Ethiopian filmmaker. He received his diploma in 1966. Costa Danya graduated in 1966, and we'll be hearing more about the student later. Sila Imi graduated in 1967. Turi Mandiu also graduated in 1967. Abbas Al-Shalah, a student from Iraq, who also graduated in the 1960s, and Abdurrahman Moulin, who received his diploma in 1967. And all of the Guineans I present here subsequently set up the main film institute or film body in their country, Sili Cinema. Sili Cinema is what you see up here on the slide. You can see the slogan and the logo, and that was set up by students who trained in the Soviet Union. Most of these students were dispatched by their government to study film specifically, and they all obtained a grant from the Soviet government, 90 rubles a month, which was a fairly significant sum. They received a more generous grant than Soviet students, which sometimes created jealousies between the students. Sometimes students made personal applications. That was the case for Suleiman Cisse, who was supported by his government, but submitted a personal request to study in Moscow. He applied as an individual rather than being dispatched directly by his government. Many of the filmmakers who went through the VGIK went to Moscow not knowing that they wanted to make films. They went to the Soviet Union because they could study and have a grant to do so. In their first year of training, they often discovered cinema. In this preparatory year, they learned Russian and were also introduced to various different disciplines. Some had classes on film, and discovering the wonders of Soviet cinema, certain of them decided to train as filmmakers themselves. When they arrived in the Soviet Union, like all other foreign students, they had to go through this first preparatory year. Those of you who were with us yesterday will have seen that in Sisako's film, there's this period of 1 year spent studying Russia. So the students didn't necessarily study Russian in Moscow, but possibly elsewhere. As for example, in this film, Sisako studied in Rostov, as is reflected in the title of his film. Let me emphasize that for most of these students, the preparatory year of Russian courses was not enough to really learn Russian. The Russian classes continued afterwards. I've interviewed some of these former students. They have told me as well that in the VGIK, in the first few months, it was sometimes very difficult. They didn't get any preferential treatment. The lecturers spoke Russian in the lectures for everybody, of course, and they made no effort to speak slowly, so you had to really concentrate to be able to keep. After a few months, however, they were able to grasp all the nuances of what the teacher and lecturer were saying. Let me underline at this point as well that these students were in groups of around 15 people. These groups comprised people from all over the world, from right across the Soviet Union and also from abroad. On these photos, you can see students in the 60s, together with Anatoly Stabilini, their lecturer. You can see Asian students, African students, Iraqi students. It was a real meeting of different cultures in these masterclasses. The students could select different departments. They could train in different filmmaking crafts. They could be trained in directing, in cinematography, in screenwriting as film critics, or in set design. After 5 years, they could graduate. Sometimes students stayed longer. In some cases, they'd decided to prepare a PhD working on a particular topic. Others had decided to have a further internship in a film studio. Most remained between 6 and up to 8 years in the Soviet Union. The courses that they took developed as a function of the political and social context, both within the Soviet Union and more broadly as well. Here you can see one of these students, Kostya Dyanya, who we'll talk about more later. And here I have a photo of Mohammed Abouloukar, who is here with us. That's the photo from his student card. Mohammed studied in the VGIK from 1966 to 1971. Konstantin Katiakoris told us yesterday that up until 68, all of the somewhat ideological courses were optional. After 1968, and because of the Prague Spring and the repercussions thereof, there was a much closer focus on ideological training of students in the Soviet Union. Here you can see a list of the courses that Mohammed Abouloukar took in 1971. There's a lot of courses relating to ideology, Marxist-Leninist philosophy, for example, economic history from the Marxist-Leninist perspective, scientific communism, scientific atheism, the Marxist-Leninist aesthetic, but also courses on psychology, art history, general cultural courses, foreign literature, music, music theory. And there were also Russian language classes. As you'll see, there's also more specific film-related courses, filmmaking for cinema and television, editing, speech mechanics, dramaturgy, film shooting, acting. Courses were included as well on production and economy, all the economic issues related to making a film. And also, of course, there was a class on the history of foreign cinema. So this slide aims to show you how broad and diverse this training was. Sometimes people view this as political indoctrination, but that was far from the case, as this list of various different courses makes very clear. The students were far from passive in these courses. All foreign students also had to make presentations to introduce their country and culture. You can see Sila Ami on the left talking about Africa. You can see the map, and on the right, you see a student demonstrating a typical instrument and typical music from his country. So the students were also encouraged to share their culture, with other students at the VGIK. These students also took part in various celebrations at the VGIK. Here, for example, 60 years of the VGIK. You can see students wearing national traditional costumes. That was as part of a procession to mark this anniversary. The courses were not held just in the VGIK, but also outside the VGIK. There were a plethora of practical exercises. Here you can see a photograph depicting students with cameras. The exercise was to go to a demonstration on the 9th of May, commemorating the end of the Second World War in the Soviet Union. The aim was to photograph the demonstration and those taking part in it. That was the kind of practical exercise carried on outside the institute, strictly speaking. And the training of these students also involved screening of films. They looked at an enormous number of films in the VGIK. It was not just Soviet films, but also French films, Italian films, Indian films, and Japanese films too. And this trained their gaze, their way of looking at the world. It shaped their filmmaking. This photograph, unfortunately, did not indicate which screening it's from. I can imagine, however, that this is a film screening with students rushing in to watch a film. Maybe the filmmakers who are here can tell me whether I've hit the nail on the head and whether they recognize this photograph and what was happening there. These years of study also involved practical tasks, either screenplay or making of a film. In fact, various different films were made. We discussed this yesterday and the day before. For those studying directing, the students, right from the very first year, had to make a silent film, a short film, 16 millimeters. And in the third year, they did an internship in a production studio in the Soviet Union and made a 35 millimeter film. And then in the fifth year, they were tasked with making a degree film. We've already seen some of these, and we'll see others subsequently today. Teachers' approaches, of course, varied. Different master classes addressed these issues in different ways. Jean-Pierre Ledot, who I interviewed and who studied in the VGIK in the 1960s, told me about the very first class that he had with the great filmmaker Michael Rom. And he told me the following. Michael Rom said to them, "What do you want me to do? Do you want me to give you a course on directing, or do you want me to tell you how we made film in the Soviet Union in the 30s? And the students said, "We want to know how Eisenstein worked, Kuleshov, for example, how you all did your work in the 1930s. And that was how the training was initially organized, by talking about the experiences gleaned in the 1930s. And it was actually only subsequently that Michael Rom introduced them to actual filmmaking, to directing with a 16 millimeter film camera. Every student made a short film which was shown to the other students, who discussed how the film had been made, how it and what improvements could be envisaged. The relationship between students and teachers was often very strong, very close. Archive documents I found confirm this, underlining that often the students had almost filial sentiments towards their teachers. Touré Monjou wrote in 1967, in his report at the end of his studies, said that he owed absolutely everything to Leonid Christie, who was both a father and a teacher to him. The Malian filmmaker Suleiman Sizé wrote in his end-of-study report how much gratitude he had to express to his master, Boris Volchek. These were reports drawn up at the end of the course, which means that, of course, we have to be careful in how we interpret them as historians. But nonetheless, this sense of gratitude really filters through. Numerous students very clearly expressed their thanks to their lecturers. Much of the training of students at the VGIK involved watching films and indeed making films. It's very interesting to look in more detail at the cinematographic work of these students and to see how through these films each of them managed to develop their own inner spirit and to render their gaze more acute, honing this gaze in order to see the world more clearly. When I present my studies in public, I often hear, well, the films of these students are propaganda films, aren't they? That's often the reaction. And then I try to address what's actually meant by the term propaganda cinema. Do we see just one type of cinema in the Soviet Union because the state was the only producer? Isn't it the case that Eisenstein's films, Rom's films, Grigory Chukrai's films, or indeed behind the films of many other filmmakers, that we have a really wide range of different gazes and perspectives despite the production framework? Every artist has their own sensibility, and this is expressed alongside depicting the dominant political message, which takes up more or less space in different films. It's true to say, however, that there were militant filmmakers amongst these students, even before some of the foreign students came to the Soviet Union. Michel Papatakis, for example, was a militant filmmaker. His film August 1927, which was made in 1965, relates to two Italian anarchists who suffered the death sentence in the United States in the 1920s. Many students talk about their own lives, what concerns them, the anti-colonialist struggle. Here you can see a photograph of a study from the degree film by Abdelrahmin Moulin, which he made in the 1960s. Here you can see a photo of a shot of the preparatory work for an anti-colonial film by an Iraqi student, again looking at the struggle to overcome colonialization. But other students in the VGIK, don't forget it was only 20 years old or so, their political background at that age was still having to emerge. It was still fledgling. It's what could be called social realism, not socialist realism, but social realism. And that's rooted in Soviet influences and indeed also in 19th century Russian literature, but also, for example, in Italian neorealism. Most of the end of studies reports written by these students expressed the students' eagerness to express the realities of their own countries and to show the lives of their compatriots. Thierry Mandieu wrote in his report, "I want to be a documentary filmmaker to show the real lives of the workers and peasants in Guinea." Suleiman Cissé, in his film L'étudiant, the postgraduate, he showed in that film an African student studying medicine in the Soviet Union. Cissé's film depicts how the student is torn between the legacy of traditional medicine in his village and Western modernity. That sort of topic crops up again and again. when we look at Costa-Gana's film in a moment, this will become quite apparent as well. Many students made thrillers or films about crimes or with detectives. Some of them based their work on novels. For example, The Killers, which is based on a novella by Ernest Hemingway. Tekken Getachew also took this approach. Literature played an enormously important role in this context. Costa-Gana, for example, drew on Alberto Moravia's work, Troppa Ricca, Too Rich, to make his degree film, La Femme, the Woman, which we will see later as well. Literature was therefore also an important source of inspiration for these students. By way of conclusion, it's difficult to provide precise figures on the number of students from Africa and the Middle East who studied in the VGIK from the late 1950s until the collapse of the Soviet Union. I know that there were 11 Guineans, 11 Ethiopians, 25 Iraqis, perhaps just as many or even more Syrians, 4 students from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I'm certain that I've forgotten many more students. I estimate that in total it was around 150 students. Today I'm talking to you just about those who studied at the VGIK, but other students were trained in other institutions, in other film schools, for example, the Leningrad Film Institute, the LIKI, which also trained a huge number of students. The same goes for Kiev University. And then, of course, there were also those students who were trained in the Eastern Bloc, the FAMU in Prague, Łódź in Poland, or indeed in East Germany. They had a striking trajectory. They encountered difficulties. In many cases, they experienced racism, even in a country that was supposed to be the home of fraternal feelings between different nationalities. But they very often formed, nonetheless, very strong and lasting friendships. Although there were not so many students studying film as perhaps studying medicine or administration, these students played an essential role for the development of their national cinema. I think it's vital to shed light on this history. That helps to establish clarity about a very important part of the film heritage in these countries. It's also very interesting in terms of looking at film history in general and to understand the legacy of this training and the impact it had on filmmakers who are still active today and also on those who will emerge as the new generation of filmmakers in the future. Thank you.
Merci, Gabriel. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you, Gabrielle.